Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A country in the grip of the virus. The death toll in the U.S. surges as hospitals grapple with a growing wave of patients. And health officials warn the worst is yet to come. Then, as COVID-19 dismantles the economy, many Americans are going hungry for the first time. And food banks struggle to meet the new demand.
There's no money to be made. It's down to like $4 in my bank account and no food. To me, it's worth it waiting for probably been over an hour already for this food bag.
Plus, the schools are closed, but the classes go on. How parents, teachers, and students are remaking education in the wake of the pandemic. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Coronavirus deaths in the United States have reached a new milestone, 3,700. That overtakes China's officially announced total of 3,300. Italy and Spain each have recorded many more deaths, while the U.S. has far and away the most cases of any country, more than 180,000 so far. President Trump warned tonight that the country faces, quote, a very tough 2 weeks. And everywhere, officials scramble to keep up. Amna Nawaz begins our coverage.
Across New York City, local landmarks are joining the front lines of the fight against coronavirus. The Javits Convention Center, now a 1,000-bed hospital, took in its first overflow patients last night. That, as New York, the epicenter of America's outbreak, saw known cases in the state top 75,000. Governor Andrew Cuomo announced he purchased 17,000 new ventilators from China. The need, he said, is desperate.
You know how you know I really, really believe that number? Because we are paying $25,000 per ventilator, and we are broke. And the last thing I want to do is buy a single ventilator that I don't need.
The need is also great in Louisiana, where 239 have now died. Governor John Bel Edwards warned today, with over 5,200 known cases and over 1,300 hospitalized, the state may run out of ventilators this weekend. He implored residents to do all they can to slow the spread.
Stay at home, stop the spread, and save lives. There's no way to see that number and not be startled. And look, I'm telling people to expect things to get worse before they get better, and I saw the number and I was startled.
Hospital beds are filling up, but streets remain largely empty across the country. As of tonight, Arizona and Tennessee joined the dozens of states limiting residents' activity outside their homes. All told, at least 32 states now have some sort of stay-at-home order in place, affecting more than three-quarters of the entire U.S. population. And those directives are unlikely to ease soon, according to projections from the White House this week. President Trump extended the social distancing guidelines until the end of April after new models estimated that between 100,000 and 200,000 Americans could die of the virus. White House lead coronavirus advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci.
If we pulled back on what we were doing and didn't extend them, there would be more avoidable suffering and avoidable death. But it was patently obvious looking at the data that at the end of the day, if we try to push back prematurely, not only would we lose lives, but it probably would even hurt the economy.
President Trump, meanwhile, proposed that the government take advantage of rock-bottom interest rates, slash to mitigate the pandemic fallout, and move forward on a, quote, very big and bold $2 trillion infrastructure bill. Leaders in other countries, like Chile and Hungary, are taking advantage of the uncertainty with power grabs, cracking down on dissenters and consolidating power. Officials at the European Union expressed concern today.
Respect of freedom of expression and legal certainty are essential in these uncertain times.
But in Europe's hardest hit nation of Italy, a glimmer of hope. A health official announcing the 3-week-long national lockdown has led to a leveling off of new infections. In memory of the thousands of Italian victims so far, a moment of silence tonight in Rome. Nearby in Spain, nearly 850 deaths today made it the country's deadliest 24-hour stretch. So on the streets of Madrid, in the pouring rain, police officers, ambulance drivers, and street cleaners stood in silence to pay their respects. In other cities, sounds of gratitude echoed in the streets, from Singapore skyscrapers to townhouses in England. Residents worldwide, stuck at home, stepped outside to take part in a new pandemic tradition, applauding medical workers fighting the virus as one shift ends and another begins. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
In the day's other news, Wall Street ended a brutal first quarter with fresh losses. The Dow Jones Industrials average dropped 410 points today to close at 21,917. It lost 23% for the quarter. That's the most since 1987. The NASDAQ fell 74 points today, and the S&P 500 slipped 42, ending its worst quarter since 2008. Online retailing giant Amazon has fired a worker who led a protest over COVID-19 protections. Christian Smalls organized a walkout on Monday at a warehouse on Staten Island. The company said that he had violated social distancing rules and refused to stay home after coming into contact with an infected coworker. Smalls said that his bosses ordered him home only to get him out of the way. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell claimed today that President Trump's impeachment trial diverted attention from the coronavirus. He appeared on a conservative radio show and said the outbreak in China during January came as the White House and Congress were distracted.
It came up while we were, you know, tied down in the impeachment trial. And I think it diverted the attention of the government. Because every day was all about impeachment.
President Trump's top aides did brief Congress on the outbreak on January 24th during the impeachment trial and again on February 5th, the day he was acquitted. But at the time, Mr. Trump maintained that the risk was low. The Trump administration today rolled back Obama-era standards for auto mileage. A new rule drops a requirement for annual increases of 5% in fuel economy. Environmental groups promised to challenge the change in court. We'll get some details later in the program. The Federal Communications Commission is taking new action against robocalls. It ordered phone companies today to implement caller ID authentication against so-called spoofing. That practice makes it appear that a robocall is coming from a local number so that people will answer. Federal judges have now blocked efforts by Alabama and Ohio to ban abortions during the coronavirus outbreak. The states had classified abortions as non-essential medical procedures. Meanwhile, Texas officials will appeal a federal judge's order that blocked a similar ban. And the college sports governing body will grant another year of eligibility to spring sport athletes after their seasons were cut short by COVID-19. The NCAA's new policy covers baseball, softball, and lacrosse. It does not include sports that had finished most or all of their playing seasons. Still to come on the NewsHour, food banks feel the strain as many Americans go hungry for the first time. Students and the pandemic, the U.S. gets an education in distance learning. A doctor and writer on how COVID-19 behaves in the body. The Trump administration rolls back the rules on the climate impact of cars, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
With unemployment soaring, the COVID-19 outbreak is taking a staggering toll on workers. As Stephanie Tsai reports, food banks are ramping up their services to meet demand, even as donations, volunteers, and supplies are pressed. Her story is also part of our Chasing the Dream series on poverty and opportunity in America.
So I'm in this line waiting. There's over 2,000 people here in this line at the United Food Bank in Mesa, Arizona.
Matthew, who preferred we not use his last name, was in a long queue leading to the parking lot of the Mesa Convention Center, waiting for a week's supply of food.
I'm here because I'm one of those gig workers. Basically, the business has dried up. There's no money to be made. It's down to like $4 in my bank account and no food. car payment's late, everything's late, so to me it's worth it waiting for, probably been over an hour already for this food bag.
So this is what they gave me. It's pretty good, man.
The distribution line is drive-through only, one of many precautions Dave Rishens, president and CEO of United Food Bank, has put in place in the wake of the outbreak.
We're going to start temperature readings on every volunteer that comes. Anybody that's not in a safe temperature range is going to be sent home. We just can't risk it.
Rishens told us by Skype they are serving four times as many people as usual, like many states, enlisting the help of the National Guard.
We're seeing the Uber driver that has no more fares to pick up. We're seeing the maid at the local hotel that is not working near as much as she used to. We're just seeing a lot more of the recently unemployed in our lines, but the elderly are still there. And so making sure those populations stay separated and safe is important. But the thing that breaks your heart the most are the families with the kids.
The food bank saw a lot of new faces.
I'm a student. I just finished at Pima. Right now they're not hiring for dental assistants, so I am just on hold because of the whole thing that's going on. So I heard on the news that, you know, I have two kids, so this would really help me out a lot.
Heidi Nitty was getting food for other people.
I'm in need to help people, the disabled, and also people that are retired that can't get out, that are sick. And mostly all this food is gonna go to people on my property where I live.
From Los Angeles, California to Duquesne, Pennsylvania, across the country, cars waiting in mile-long lines to receive food packages. Since the coronavirus outbreak began, food banks have seen demand increase by as much as 50% in some places, says Claire Babineau-Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S.
We've seen this before, just never at this magnitude. The average American does not have $400 in cash available to deal with a financial emergency. People started losing their jobs. People started missing checks. Most people in this country are one check away from being in need of some new source of food and other things that are necessary for sustenance.
What about the impacts on all of the many people that volunteer their time at food banks, many of whom I would guess are elderly?
Our volunteers are inordinately elderly. Consequently, we have a bit of a perfect storm going on right now. So we have increase in demand, decrease in supply, and a significant decrease in our volunteer workforce. Some of that decrease in workforce is us wanting to look out for the safety of the people who are there trying to help us, and they're particularly vulnerable.
Folks, we are sold out of paper towels and toilet.
The mad rush for supplies as families prepared and stockpiled for home lockdowns had the knock-on effect of limiting donations from major retail grocers that food banks rely on.
All right, thank you all.
The recently passed CARES Act directs more federal funds to food insecurity, including $300 million for purchases for the Emergency Food Assistance Program. But Babineau-Fontenot is worried about the needs gap, and her organization issued a statement criticizing lawmakers for not increasing SNAP benefits in the act, saying they missed an opportunity to help families facing hunger, and unfortunately, food banks will bear the burden of this oversight.
It's not enough. But we've made some good progress. Our data shows us that the hole is a lot bigger than the additional supplemental food that we're going to be able to rely upon from the federal government. With the contracting amount of retail donations, with a bigger population of people in need, we're having to go out and purchase more food, and we're competing in the marketplace in a scarcity.
Back at the United Food Bank, Dave Rishens says supplies from the USDA will help him keep things going at this pace through August.
As long as we continue to get trucks coming to our warehouse and delivering food, we can continue to get to the public. There's nothing that's going to stop us from filling our mission. I'll keep serving until the last can of food is on the shelf of the food bank.
His biggest worry isn't keeping the food supplies coming, but keeping his own employees and volunteers safe from the spreading virus. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix.
One of the many consequences of asking Americans to stay home is what it has meant for schools, teaching, and learning. For most, the normal school day has been halted, at least for now. We're going to focus on different aspects of this periodically. Let's start with what it means to be teaching from a distance, learning from home, and coping with children at home all day. This is one way teachers and students see each other in the age of coronavirus, organizing parades in small towns where they wave from a distance. More than 55 million American students are now out of school and expected to learn from home. To find out how that's going, we talked to a handful of parents and teachers.
I'm Dawn Bishop MacLean in Madison, Mississippi. I'm a mother of two girls. We start every morning about 8:30. We have a schedule. And that schedule is a blessing because it keeps us on track.
It's been a tough adjustment. My name is Aaron Warner. I'm from South Burlington, Vermont, and I have a son who is 9 years old.
My name is Megan Smith, and I live in Seldovia, Alaska. I'm a teacher, and I teach 6th through 12th grade. And I have two kids. Cecilia is in kindergarten. She is 6. And Kaylee is in 3rd grade, and she is 8. It's challenging to not be able to sit one-on-one with a student and really help them understand what they're missing. And I think as a parent, my biggest challenge is just going to be how often can I be available and teaching my own children that they're just gonna have to be a little bit more independent and do things on their own.
With my son being autistic, a lot of times there are these things where I can't just be like, hey, you know, here's a math worksheet from your teacher, spend 30 minutes on this. I have to sit there with him and we go through it. I probably only worked 15 hours last week at my regular job, just because I was taking on all this other stuff, and it was important to make sure that he had some consistency from as we make this transition, because it's hard for him.
That transition in some cases has been helped along by technology, play dates via iPad, classroom video conference calls on a technology called Zoom.
My name is Sarah Solis, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have two kids, and they are 8 and 11. One day we watched the live Facebook stream from the Cincinnati Zoo because every day they've been doing a show and tell with a different animal. Every hour, every couple hours, I try to kind of pick something that they can work on. And then eventually, you know, I just give up and let them play Minecraft.
My name is Ricky House. I am a 11th and 12th grade social studies teacher at Woodrow Wilson High School in the District of Columbia. My biggest thing for the past week and a half has just been communicate, communicate, communicate. There are definitely some students who, the minute I post an assignment in the morning, they're going to get right to it and hand it in. You have other students who, there are some barriers. We found out last week that a lot of students, 30% of the student population in DC, I think, does not have access to technology. So they're preparing to give out devices to those students who are in need, I think, in the coming weeks.
The technology gap is something school districts are grappling with from east to west, passing out laptops and tablets where possible, driving Wi-Fi buses to internet-free zones.
We do have a couple students at the school that we put all paper book packets together and gave them work that way.
I'm a professor of psychology at Jackson State University. I know some challenges for my college students are some don't have adequate Wi-Fi. Some live in rural areas here in Mississippi. There's still a digital divide among minority populations in their community. So I've had to adjust how I teach.
And as for the challenges of being home all the time.
Last week hit, and I think the realization kind of started that this is going to be the new norm for a while. And we had a lot more feelings, just a lot more anxiety and kind of refusal to do the work, basically. So we're kind of working through that.
Not everything I do is, you know, academic per se. I feel like there are lots of things, you know, they can learn from. We learned to make pretzels, for example, and that was really fun. But yeah, I mean, it has been challenging. It's hard to get my work done. It's hard to, you know, not go crazy in your house and feel like you're just living in a junk pile.
And teacher and parent Megan Smith had one final note of advice for parents.
We don't need to be totally solely focused on academics, because at school, that's not what the school day looks like. I would say don't beat up yourself as a parent. If your kid is not engaged academically all day long, they really are going to be fine.
For more now on the challenges presented by distance learning, I'm joined by Kate Gardoki. She is a former teacher herself who now designs curriculum and trains other teachers. She's a senior associate with the Great Schools Partnership, and she joins me via Skype from Maine. So, Kate Gardoki, how big a challenge are we talking about for these millions of students and teachers and parents?
Well, this is a tremendous challenge. There's just no way to overestimate it. If we think about those groups one by one, for the teachers and the educators, everyone involved in every school district, they had, in some cases, 24 or 48 hours to prepare to completely re-envision what education looks like. And they did it with great creativity. It's monumental. And for our students, we asked them also to re-envision what learning looks like, to re-envision what their social lives look like. And for parents, as we just heard, we're hearing from so many parents trying to educate their children, take care of their children, and do their own jobs at the same time.
It's just remarkable. How different is it for when you're teaching elementary, primary grade students, young students versus middle school and high school? Is one or the other particularly harder, or is there a great difference?
I think each of those age levels has its own challenges. The high school students may be able to learn more effectively on their own, or they may be able to, you know, govern themselves more effectively. But the depth of what we ask of them is so huge that there's really just great challenges all around.
What are the main things, Kate Gardoki, that are lost when you don't have that person-to-person contact, the eye contact that you have in a classroom?
You know, I've worked in schools all my life, and the thing that most characterizes so many amazing teachers is the depth of love and caring that they give to students. And I think that's been one of the hardest things for teachers, is that they can't check in with those kids that they really love and care about, look in their eyes, look at their body language, see how they're doing. And I know that there are schools out there that have divided up their whole student population, and they're making sure that every kid has one teacher or one educator who is checking in on them on a regular basis. And I think that's a great practice that schools have used to try to fill that gap.
And is there some formula for what part of this is the clearly a lot, it's the student's responsibility in large part, but what part of this is the parent's responsibility and what part is the teacher's?
Well, I think right now, you know, in this unprecedented moment, all we can ask is for everybody to do their best and to keep the children first, to constantly ask, how are the children doing? And so for parents, that means checking in as much as we can, setting up those schedules, also giving kids some freedom to just de-stress. And for teachers and for educators, it means setting up as many ways as we can to figure out what kids might be falling through the cracks, what kids are missing out on what we're trying to share with them, and how can we stop that from happening? How can we reach out to the kids who need the most?
And I know there's no one piece of advice that fits every circumstance, but in general, what advice do you have for parents who are watching and wondering if they're doing the right thing, what more can they be doing?
Well, I would say kids know how to learn. That's what kids are best at. And so, you know, in this time, the most important things are to check in with your kids and give them lots of love and support. push them to think and push them to read, you know, talk about what's happening in the world in ways that are age appropriate and ask some good questions and try to make sure that they're reading. And those are the most important things that, we can do to support our kids right now.
And because I'm thinking parents have to be out there who are juggling work and time that they think they should be spending with their children, and they have to be feeling guilty or worried.
Yeah, that's it's so hard for all of our parents, for all of our teachers. And so the other thing that as parents, you know, and as teachers, that we have to do is try to do our best, show our students love, let our students know that we know they're learning and that we can see everything they're learning on their own. They may be dealing with stress by playing the guitar for 3 hours. Or by talking with friends and supporting them, or maybe they're reaching out to grandparents. And so as parents and teachers, we want to be recognizing those things that kids are doing and honoring that and asking how can that become what our students learn during this time.
Kate Gardoki, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we will continue to report on this topic in coming days with a look at the particular challenges involved in teaching children with learning disabilities and special needs. We've spent much time looking at how to cope with COVID-19, its impact, and worldwide disruption. Tonight, we're going to try to understand a little more about what we're learning about the novel coronavirus itself and how it behaves. Jeffrey Brown has our conversation.
And for that, I'm joined by Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's an oncologist, cancer researcher, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and he's just written a new article on COVID-19 for The New Yorker. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. You wrote that so far we've been measuring the spread of the virus across people. We need to start measuring within people. Can you explain what you mean by that and why it's important?
Well, during a pandemic like this, the first thing that we want to do is to track how fast it's moving across populations. And that's what I mean by measuring virus across people. That's really an on-off, zero, one, plus, minus kind of assessment. Are you infected? Are you not infected? Are you symptomatic? Are you not symptomatic? But then there's a second phase of the pandemic when you need to begin to understand the dynamics of the virus within people, which is how much virus were you exposed to? How much virus does that exposure lead to an infection? And are you immune once you get the virus? Do you get immunity to the virus? These are things that help us understand the dynamics of the epidemic as it moves across a population.
Well, so there's still so much mystery about what happens when it attacks one person as opposed to another. What have we learned so far that helps us respond?
Well, there's several things we've learned. First of all, we've learned that that the virus is mainly transmitted through respiratory droplets or so-called fomites. That's the main mode of transmission. The second thing that we've learned, that we're trying to learn, we're in the middle of learning, is that that there are several people who are asymptomatic who may be shedding virus. That's a very, very important idea. That is to say that there may be a child or someone who doesn't have any symptoms, no fever, no diarrhea, no respiratory symptoms, but nonetheless is shedding the virus. We need to identify those people and isolate and potentially quarantine them so that they don't keep spreading the virus. The third thing that we are learning, which we haven't learned for sure, is that there seems to be, if you do the right kind of test, there seems to be a way to predict whether you're going to have very severe disease versus a more mild form of the disease. And that helps because that will help us triage patients who are either going to be sick and therefore require urgent attention versus those who may become less sick and may be able to be managed more conservatively.
Do these individual responses have implications for current discussions about, for example, wearing masks, whether all of us should wear masks?
Well, so absolutely they have an enormous role in this. I think the general conclusion, although we don't know this empirically, what one would logically conclude from this information is that healthcare workers need full masks, and by that I mean they need the really protective masks. Those are N95 masks. If you are not a healthcare worker and you happen to have an N95 mask, please do a social service and donate it to a healthcare worker. So that's the first thing that we need, that we know. The second thing that we know is that for most respiratory viruses, if the viral load isn't the kind of viral load that a healthcare worker is receiving, there is a mountain of evidence that suggests that a simple surgical mask is essential. It works, such a mask works in conjunction with hand hygiene and social distancing. These are not, this is not to say you should stop practicing hand hygiene and social distancing, but it is to say that if you are an essential worker, and if you're being asked to work during this time, I do think that wearing a simple surgical mask would be effective and would be helpful in trickling down the amount of infection. If you happen to have an N95 respirator, please consider donating it to a healthcare worker who desperately needs one.
You know, you wrote in your article that every virus has its own personality, and I wonder, how different is COVID-19, and how confident are you that we will come to understand it enough to help in time?
I'm very confident that we will understand it in time. COVID-19 is a unique virus, but it belongs to a family of viruses, including SARS and MERS and other coronaviruses that we have been dealing with for a very long time. It is not something peculiar and mysterious that is suddenly emerged. We know this family of viruses well enough. We are in the midst, as a medical community, in the midst of launching an extraordinary phase of drug trials to treat the sickest patients. So if there's one message I would say with regard to the virus is that you need the population, the public, everyone needs to buy us time. We need time to get these trials launched. We need time to get to ensure that they're done correctly, so that when the full wave of the sickest patients hits us, we will be prepared for them.
Before we go, I want to ask you, there's a new documentary about to come out on PBS called The Gene. It's based on your book of a few years ago. And it makes us all, I think, wonder about the analogy or the connection, rather, between that history that you're documenting about the genetic code and what's going on today with this virus, how we're trying to understand it, how we're trying to respond.
Virtually every technology that we're using to quantify, understand, and deepen our understanding of COVID-19 relies on genetics. There is, you know, the word viral load really is a quantification of the amount of virus in the body using genetic techniques. So, and also the production of drugs such as antibodies depends on recombinant DNA technology. To understand how the last 100 years of genetic medicine and genetic technologies have impacted our understanding of infectious diseases and pandemics such as COVID, I would encourage you to watch it.
All right, so you and I will talk a little bit more about the documentary, and we'll put that online in the coming days. For now, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Hope you stay well.
Thank you. You too.
And you can watch The Gene on your PBS station starting next week. It airs in two parts on April 7th and April 14th. It's hard to focus on anything aside from COVID-19 these days, but it remains important to keep an eye on how the federal government is working in other ways. The Trump administration today moved to roll back another federal regulation intended to reduce global warming. As John Yang reports, today's announcement targeted automobile mileage standards.
Judy, today's proposal would undercut Obama administration fuel efficiency standards intended to combat climate change. It would require U.S. vehicles to improve mileage standards an average of 1.5% between 2021 through 2026 instead of 5% a year. Juliet Eilpern is senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. She covers federal environmental policy, and she joins us by Skype. Juliet, how big a deal is this?
This is quite significant. It affects the cars, trucks, and SUVs that Americans across the country drive and will be driving for decades to come, because while this affects, obviously, the kind of cars that are built over the next 7 years, people hold on to those cars for some time. So it really will have a tremendous effect in terms of what are the standards that auto manufacturers will meet and what's the kind of pollution and affordability of the cars that we'll be driving.
And what's the administration's rationale or justification for this change?
They are arguing that the Obama administration, who initially set carbon and fuel efficiency standards in 2009 and updated them in 2012, really set too stringent a target in the years to come. And that, in other words, they are too expensive for manufacturers to meet. And as a result, they argue Americans would actually hold on to older, dirtier cars rather than buying new.
And who are the opponents of today's proposal, and what are they saying in response?
There's a slew of groups that are opposed to this, starting with the state of California and more than a dozen other states in the District of Columbia, who had adopted stringent standards and are trying to push ahead with them, even though the administration is trying to roll them back. And they're joined by a coalition of environmental and public health groups who argue that for two reasons you need to keep these standards in place. One, because they address the kind of traditional air pollution that kills people, and two, because they curb the CO2 that comes out of tailpipes and obviously contributes to climate change. So for those reasons, they're adamantly opposed to making these mileage standards less stringent.
And the auto industry is split on this, is that right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really interesting. It was the auto industry that initially asked President Trump within a matter of days of him taking office that they wanted to relax these standards. But they, in some ways, had second thoughts because they thought that there could be a compromise between the Trump administration and, again, state officials in California and other states who did want to see cleaner cars and trucks. And so they had assumed that they would meet somewhere in the middle. Instead, what they saw was this split. And so you had a handful of major manufacturers, including, for example, Ford and Honda and BMW, who reached an agreement last summer with California saying that they would go ahead and meet the stricter standards. And then you have others such as GM and Chrysler who said, no, we'll just abide by what the Trump administration is going to do. This has caused a real dilemma for auto manufacturers, because they may face competing standards, and no matter what, there'll be an extended legal fight that will leave this question unanswered for some time to come.
So, I mean, talk about that legal fight. Who's fighting? It's the states, and are some of the automakers joining that fight?
It's a little unclear, although it is true that, for example, when some of these auto manufacturers struck a deal in July with California, part of the agreement was that they would defend California's right to set its own standards. So you could easily see some of the auto manufacturers siding with the administration and some siding with California and the states who want stricter mileage standards. They'll certainly be joined by, as we said, almost, you know, every major environmental group and multiple attorneys general, particularly from Democratic states. You'll see some of those also arguing that they have a vested interest in cutting the pollution from cars and trucks because it affects everything from climate impacts to their states to the air that their citizens breathe.
Deregulation has been a big part of what the Trump administration, what President Trump has wanted to accomplish. Is there any sense that they're moving things forward to get it in before the election?
They are absolutely advancing their deregulatory agenda on this front and many others. When I talk to some of the Trump administration officials, as well as the career folks who work with them, they are keenly aware of the fact that there is a provision called the Congressional Review Act, which allows a president and Congress to overturn regulations if they're enacted within 60 days. And so this was, for example, a very effective tool that Republicans used once Trump came into office to overturn some of the last rules that the Obama administration took it put in place. The Trump officials are keenly aware if under some scenario they lose the White House and Democrats gain control of the Senate while holding onto the House, some of their policies could also be overturned. So what we're seeing right now is a real push to finalize some of their highest priority rollback so that they can stay in place even if you have a new president.
Juliet Alpern of the Washington Post, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
President Trump was at the podium again late today taking questions on the pandemic. Our Yamiche Alcindor joins me now from the White House for the latest. So, Yamiche, we know that the official death toll from coronavirus in the United States has now moved past 3,700. What are they saying at the White House about the pace of this outbreak?
Well, Judy, the number of people who have died from coronavirus hit a really grim total today. More people have died from the virus in America than on the morning of 9/11. That sobering tone, that sadness, was really apparent in today's White House briefing. There were models shown that showed even with the best social distancing, something like 100,000 Americans could still die of this virus. Now, health officials and President Trump said that they're doing all that they can to make that number even lower. But again, and that figure is if people do all that they can around the country to social distance and to try to combat this virus. The other thing to note is that the White House is saying that the testing and ventilators and all this equipment that governors are saying they need are being given to them as soon as possible. But the message today coming from the White House was every American needs to do what they have to do in order for this not to be even more deadly. There was a figure shown that said 2.2 million people could die if nothing had been done in the United States. So really, today was a really sad day at the White House, and the president's tone was markedly changed because of that.
Those numbers are just breathtaking. Yamiche, and what are they saying about federal government efforts and what the federal government can do at this point?
Well, we've heard governors over and over again say that they need medical equipment from the federal government. And today the president said that he's holding back on some at least 10,000 ventilators in the federal stockpile because he wants to see how bad the surge is going to get. And he said that's really emergency equipment that he wants to send out at a later date. Now, governors, again, are saying they need that equipment as soon as possible. The other thing to note, though, the president made a pretty sobering statement when it came to what's ahead. He said that the peak is in about 2 weeks. So let's listen to what he said.
I want every American to be prepared for the hard days that lie ahead. We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks. And then hopefully, as the experts are predicting, as I think a lot of us are predicting after having studied it so hard, you're going to start seeing some real light at the end of the tunnel. As a nation, we face a difficult few weeks as we approach that really important day when we're going to see things get better all of a sudden. And it's going to be like a burst of light, I really think, and I hope.
Now, that's a lot different from what the president said in the past. In the past, he said that coronavirus was like the flu. But today, he said it's not the flu. It's much more vicious. So the president at the White House was really trying to tell Americans to brace themselves. And that was also the message that health officials and top White House officials were giving today.
And Yamiche, finally, it was just a few days ago that the Congress passed and the president signed this emergency coronavirus relief aid bill, $2.2 trillion in there. But already there's talk of more legislation.
That's right. That legislation, that piece of legislation that you just mentioned, the $2.2 trillion coronavirus bill, it was the largest single stimulus package ever signed into law. But already we're hearing that another package is underway. I want to put up for people some of the things that people are talking about. They're talking about infrastructure investment. So that would be maybe more clean water as well as broadband internet because everyone's doing so much video conferencing. There's also more direct aid to Americans and paid leave to workers trying to help people get through this economic tragedy that we're going going through right now, and also more funds to states and localities. Now, I should say that President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi have been out talking about what they want to see in the next bill, and there is some overlap there. They're both talking about infrastructure. So we've been hearing for 3 years that this is a White House and that Democrats want to do something on infrastructure in this country. They might now be getting it done because of this pandemic.
Yamiche Alcindor following this late day briefing at the White House. Yamiche, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And now, how is this virus affecting the U.S. military and in particular one aircraft carrier based in the Pacific? We turn now to our foreign affairs and defense correspondent, Nick Schifrin. So, Nick, this is about the U.S. Navy, the ship in the Pacific. They've just held a conference call. Tell us what they're saying.
Yeah, Judy, that conference call is ongoing, but the head of the U.S. Navy in the Pacific Ocean, Admiral John Aquino, was discussing the Theodore Roosevelt, and he says that they're taking extraordinary actions to try and isolate soldiers on that ship, testing them while in quarantine. But I have to say that what he just announced is not what the captain of the ship has been asking for. Some number of hundreds, perhaps in the thousands, of sailors from the USS Theodore Roosevelt are leaving that ship right now. But the admiral specifically said that they would not accede to the request by the captain of the ship, which was really an extraordinary one, to take 90% of the ship off and keep 10% on the ship in order to clean the ship and maintain the nuclear reactor on that ship. And what the captain said was basically, we needed to do this because everyone on this ship was working too closely together and that we couldn't keep the sailors safe. There have been dozens of cases of COVID-19 on that ship. And he wrote a real plea to the Pentagon in a letter yesterday, Judy. Let me just read just part of it. Quote, decisive action is required. Removing the majority of personnel from a deployed U.S. nuclear aircraft carrier and isolating them for 2 weeks may well seem like an extraordinary measure, but keeping over 4,000 young men and women aboard the Theodore Roosevelt is an unnecessary risk and breaks faith with those sailors entrusted to our care. Judy, Admiral Aquino from the U.S. Navy in the Pacific said that that was not going to happen, that he said, quote, there has never been an intent to take all the sailors off that ship.
Still a lot of questions then about this decision. But quickly, Nick, how concerned is the military from your reporting about other ships that are out there around the world?
Well, the military says it's concerned about other ships, but I have to say, Judy, with this decision, they are clearly saying that they need to maintain readiness over maintaining the pure safety of all those sailors on the ship. And that's why the message today is that that ship would not be evacuated. The experts I talked to fear that a lot of these Navy ships are like cruise ships. They're basically incubators for disease like COVID-19, and the sailors simply are working too close together in order to keep them all safe.
It just raises the question, how can one have readiness if the sailors themselves are not healthy?
Right. That is the short-term and long-term question. You have to keep the sailors safe and you have to keep the sailors healthy short-term in order to maintain long-term readiness. At least that's what the experts are saying.
Nick Schifrin reporting for us. Thank you, Nick. Even amid all the current fear and uncertainty, people are reading, and we are hearing of book clubs continuing remotely. It's the same for us, and we wanted to continue our Now Read This book club. As it happened, this month's book addresses themes relevant to the moment. Jeffrey Brown is back, and he has that for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Our book club pick for March is Inheritance, a memoir by Dani Shapiro about her reckoning with an ancestry test that revealed a life-changing family secret. The beloved man who had raised her was not her biological father. Shapiro's book is a personal exploration of genealogy, medical ethics, and above all, enduring love. The author joins me from her home in Bethlehem, Connecticut, to answer some of your questions now.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you, Jeff.
So you learned that you're not exactly who you are, to put it in a nutshell. What was this book for you?
This book was a reckoning with my very identity. When I made the discovery about my dad, it was as if I had to reshuffle and re-remember and re-understand pretty much every story that I had ever been told or every story that I had told about myself.
So readers had a lot of questions along those lines, of course, and one is about your dad, how you came to think about him, how this changed. He had died years before all this, but your book is partly looking at that relationship.
When I first made this discovery, I felt betrayed by my parents. But over the course of this journey, I came to actually feel that my father was more of a father to me than I had ever even felt before. And he was, as you said, very beloved to me.
One of the remarkable aspects of this is how you retrace exactly what happened, how this happened, and what exactly happened, and who knew what when.
I found myself thrust into the world of my parents in the early 1960s, the choices that they made, being an infertile couple, which was such a source of trauma and shame back then, and the steps that they took, which I had to retrace. I mean, in a way, there was a ticking clock the entire time I was working on Inheritance, because anyone who might still have known anything about the truth of the story was, if they were still living, was very old. What I came to understand was that my biological father had been a sperm donor as a young medical student. You know, he had been an anonymous sperm donor. I didn't ask to be conceived or born this way or to make this discovery, but I did, as so many people are. And the whole question of what is our moral responsibility to each other, which was and continues to be profound. I did meet him. And I would say that we have a really lovely friendship now. He doesn't feel like my father. The man who raised me is my dad.
You have told me before that since this book came out and when you were on book tour, you had so many people come up to you or write to you to tell you about their own experiences.
It's this really extraordinary time where secrets are tumbling out. And, you know, in the end, I haven't met anyone who wishes that they hadn't found out. I haven't met one person who wished that they hadn't known, because in some way, when you do make a discovery like this, even if it's shocking, it also makes an incredible amount of sense.
I just can't help but think of this to set it in the moment that we're in. You're writing of family, of knowing yourself better, of realizing your history. So many of us are thinking about those things now. You?
Oh, yeah, now more than ever. And one of the things I've been thinking about is that when you make this kind of discovery, the very first feeling often that people have is feeling threatened, which is, I think, something that many of us are feeling right now. And in fact, one of the extraordinary things that's happened in my thinking as a result of my journey, my family, who raised me, have been unfailingly kind and compassionate in the wake of this discovery. The family that I discovered, who are my genetic family, unfailingly kind. And I think that the antidote to that kind of threatened feeling is kindness and compassion. But we are actually all in this together.
All right. The book is Inheritance. Danny Shapiro, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And before we go, I want to give our pick for April. It's called Disappearing Earth, a novel by Julia Phillips about a community upended by the sudden disappearance of two young girls, set on Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula. Now more than ever, we hope you'll read along with us, get involved with many other engaged readers and members around the country, and join us on our Facebook page and here on the NewsHour for Now Read This, our book club partnership with the New York Times.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again right here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.